I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of the LRB podcast is supported by Pace Gallery London. This summer, Pace Gallery will be staging the first solo exhibition in London of works by the pioneering artist Kiki Kogelnik, whose visual language, developed from the 1960s, involved a sardonic feminist critique of the technopolitics of the Cold War. Opening on Friday the 24th of May, the dance will include painting, sculpture, works on paper and ceramics that span three decades of production, and reflect Kogelnik's long-standing interest in the utopian possibilities of outer space. Kogelnik, who until recently has been under-recognised, commented explicitly on the representation of women in modern society, and her work has an irony and pessimism that diverged ideologically from the canonical pop art of some of her contemporaries. The exhibition will be free to visit and will run until the 3rd of August, no booking required, and it will be held at Pace's Hanover Square Gallery in London. For more information, visit pacegallery.com/exhibitions. You're listening to the London Review of Books podcast. I'm Thomas Jones, and I'm joined today by Sophie Smith, a historian of political thought who teaches at University College Oxford and is finishing a book about women and the history of ideas. She had a piece recently in the LRB reviewing two books, How to Think Like a Woman, Four Women Philosophers Who Taught Me How to Love the Life of the Mind by Regan Penaluna, and The Routledge Handbook of Women and Early Modern European Philosophy, edited by Karen Detlefsen and Lisa Shapiro. So, hello, Sophie, and thank you very much for joining me.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
So, since reading your piece, I had a look at the contents pages of some best-selling popular histories of philosophy. So, Bertrand Russell's History of Western Philosophy, published in 1946, has 31 chapters. None of them is devoted to a woman philosopher. A.C. Grayling's History of Philosophy, published in 2019, has 5 pages on feminist philosophy, which could be seen as a slight improvement, but on the other hand. And in your piece, you mentioned Richard Whatmore's book, What is Intellectual History?, published in 2016, which, as you put it, managed to stay silent on centuries of attempts to recover and reflect on women's thinking. So, as your piece makes clear, the intellectual contributions of women to the development of philosophical thought has been considerable, but they have been repeatedly left out of intellectual history. So, to turn that into a question, how and why have women philosophers been written out of the history of philosophy?
Yeah, so I think when we talk about women in the history of philosophy, and really more broadly women in intellectual history, the history of ideas, you know, ideologies, arguments, intellectualism, whatever you want to call it, it is important to kind of begin by distinguishing between at least two contexts. I mean, I'm simplifying here, but basically on the one hand, we have what we might call the kind of mainstream histories that you were just talking about, Tom, and they come in their kind of popular guises, but also, you know, in their academic guises. There are plenty of, you know, very serious histories of philosophy, which are meant as kind of serious scholarly interventions, which also have nothing to say about women. So I don't want to suggest this is just in the kind of, you know, popular histories, but let's just call them the mainstream histories, right? The histories that are written by people with some degree of public prominence or disciplinary standing. And these are the histories which have consistently, from at least, as I said, sort of the mid-19th century, acted as if women don't exist. And some of them were kind of hilariously overt about it. So you mentioned Bertrand Russell's, but one of my favorites was written in 1951 by a professor of history at Harvard. And he just called it Ideas and Men, the Story of Western Thought. And so there was something kind of very bold and honest about that approach. And of course, histories like this are hugely important for the story of explaining why generations of students weren't taught about women. And as you say, you know, there are questions about why those men who wrote those histories had so little, if anything at all, to say about the very women philosophers and thinkers who sort of wrote alongside the men that they do write about. And I think, you know, in this case, there are all sorts of different answers we might give that are usually kind of contextually dependent answers, but we see repeated themes. So one of the things I mentioned in the piece is that recent work by the philosopher Sabrina Emmersmeyer showed that if you look at histories of philosophy in Germany in the 18th century, what's fascinating about them, even the mainstream ones, they'll have plenty to say about women thinkers. You move to the middle of the 19th century and men who are in sort of similar positions, similar disciplinary standing, are writing histories in which those women are suddenly absent. And Emmersmeyer, I think, makes a really convincing case that you can only understand, you know, this disappearance. I know we're going to talk about the kind of apt language for how to characterize what went on here later, but you can only really understand this disappearance in the context of a new wave of activism, which was arguing for women's access to the university and to higher education. If we were to simplify this, we'd say, look, these men who are writing these histories were against the admission of women to the university, and they fiddled with history in order to make it support their argument that women's minds just weren't suited to higher learning, right? They shouldn't be in this kind of context. They should be in the home. And it didn't matter that they had plenty of evidence to the contrary. So I guess, you know, in some cases, the answer to your question is that, you know, the absence of women from mainstream intellectual history is sort of political all the way down. It's been about making history conform to a contemporary narrative about women's capabilities and their limits and their so-called natures. But the one thing I was going to say is that, or add to this, is that, you know, in other cases, I think we do see different kinds of failure at work. So sort of lazy sexism or a more general intellectual laziness. Because if you think that a sort of one job of the historian is to question received beliefs and to ask whether the evidence we have supports, you know, the reigning accounts of the past that we give, when it comes to women, many male intellectual historians or historians of philosophy have just shown themselves to be quite shockingly uncurious. So in some cases, the problem is that historians of philosophy are uncurious about women. In some cases, the problem is, as I said, a sort of lazy sexism. In other cases, it's obviously more complicated, right? You mentioned Bertrand Russell. I don't think we can put that down to some kind of very easy or overt prejudice, because Russell joined the suffrage movement and wrote very interestingly about discovering quite how many women were anti-suffrage. And he was quite sort of appalled and moved by this. But there's one other thing that we want to say. I sort of started out by saying that we should distinguish between two contexts, the kind of mainstream histories. But another side to the story of the erasure, or at least the kind of attempted erasure of women from these mainstream histories of philosophy, is that then those mainstream histories are not the whole story when it comes to thinking about past attempts to write the history of ideas. So although they were a lot less prominent, there were and have always been attempts to correct the record. These are often books written by women outside of the academy, in part because for so long women were excluded from the academy. And they're books that make the case for women's minds and women's thinking, right? They're trying to write women back into the history of ideas. And at this point, I think, you know, we need to ask, well, why does the existence of these alternative histories, these marginalized histories, matter so much? In part because it closes off one answer to your question, Tom, right? Why have women thinkers been written out of mainstream histories? Well, what we cannot say is something like, oh, well, we just didn't know about them. They just didn't know about them, right? They're just conforming to the norms of the time. I mean, I've had that said to me by teachers when I asked about the absence of women. Well, you know, it's just a very recent thing that we've come to know about these women. But these absences cannot be put down to some kind of, you know, transtemporal, transhistorical ignorance. And, you know, I think the very fact that there are these books and there are these women saying, hang on a second, you know, women did some thinking too. The question then becomes, why weren't the men listening? Why weren't they engaging? Why weren't they taking this work seriously? Now, again, we might want to fall back on claims about longstanding prejudices about who counts as a thinker, and I'm sure that's right. But I think there's probably also more to the story about not wanting to share certain goods around.
Yeah, I mean, there is that question of the word forgetting and forgotten, this claim that women have been forgotten. And one of the things that, well, as you say in the piece, well, who is doing the forgetting? That history can't forget because it's not conscious in that way. So what is the use of that word? And also the way that this forgetting seems to happen over and over again. There's this sort of continuous amnesia, that the recovery happens and then it's mysteriously re-forgotten, and then it happens again and people say, well, we didn't know. But as you say, people did know. So, I mean, is the use of the word forgotten? I mean, is there some ideological force behind it?
I mean, I think so. I, as will be clear to anyone who's read the piece, I loathe the language of forgetting when it's used in this context. And in part because it diverts our focus from what's actually going on when, not just when, you know, men write histories of philosophy that don't include women, but when, you know, men like Richard Watmore write a book. You mentioned the book, What is Intellectual History? And he's surveying, you know, hundreds of years of historical writing and doesn't think to include a single text that has said anything about the history of women's thought. So what do students who read that book think about the practice of writing intellectual history? Well, at a minimum, they think, you know, it just didn't happen. Intellectual historians have never cared about women. There have never been people who understand themselves, who understand their professional vocation as telling us about the history of intellectualism, who focused on women. That's false. And perhaps then they also think, and this is something I worry about as a teacher, oh, well, it's up to us to do all of this work anew. So these women who have actually been, and they do tend to be women, who've been writing the history of women's ideas tend to be subject to kind of double erasure, right? They don't appear in these books reviewing the history of history, but they also then don't appear in the footnotes of the people who are quite earnestly writing about women in the present. To move specifically onto the language of forgetting, look, when we talk about forgetting, my issue with the language of forgetting is partly conceptual. So to say that someone has forgotten something is to suggest that they at one point knew it. And it is also, I think, in most kind of common sense usages of the term, to suggest that the fact that they no longer know it is somewhat blameless, right? We tend not to think people who've forgotten something are in any way robustly blameworthy. And especially in cases of amnesia, right? You'd be considered very wrong-headed if you tried to blame someone with amnesia for forgetting something. And yet, I think, so this is why I think the language of forgetting is exculpatory, because I think that it allows us to assume that the project here is sort of innocent, that these men aren't breaking any norms of their discipline when they don't write about women. I suppose the real problem with forgetting is that I think it is true to say that the histories of philosophy that have nothing to say about women are histories that have failed to fulfill some very basic disciplinary norms around carefulness with historiography and carefulness with evidence, right? And I think that when we suggest that men have merely forgotten women, we close down the space for making that kind of critique.
Sophie will be back in a moment after I've told you a bit about Helen Edmondson's play Quorum Boy at Chichester Festival Theatre from the 24th of May to the 15th of June. Based on Jamila Gavin's Whitbread Award-winning novel and set in 18th century England with music by Handel, among others, the play premiered at the National Theatre in 2005 and won a Time Out Live Award before transferring to Broadway. This new production, sponsored by the Portsmouth Grammar School, is directed by Anna Ledwich, who describes Quorum Boy as epic, rich and theatrical. Tickets start at £10 and you can book them at cft.org.uk. So people talk about pre-Socratic philosophy and that, so the idea that Socrates is a new kind of beginning in philosophy. But we don't have anything that Socrates wrote himself, that most of it is reported by Plato, also by Xenophon and others. But no one is in any doubt that Socrates was a philosopher and said some version of the wise things that are reported by Plato and so on. And the other characters, for want of a better word, in Plato's dialogues, who are mostly men, many of them we know are historical figures. Alcibiades, for example, or you know, they're well known to the historical record. But there's also a character in the symposium, and all right, she's not there, but Socrates tells everyone that what he's going to tell them he learned from a woman called Diotima. And there's no evidence that we know of for her outside the symposium. People have assumed, they say we don't know if she was real or not. Maybe she was a fictional creation. Somehow the men, we know these men were all real, even though Plato has to some extent fictionalized them. But this woman who said all these wise things to Plato, Plato probably made her up. I mean, what does that tell us about the attitudes to...
Yeah, this is one of those moments when one wonders if you even need an analysis. I mean, it's fascinating to think about what in the world that, you know, Plato conjures is assumed by readers to be merely fictional and what's assumed to be factually accurate. Actually, when I think about how people have approached Diotima, I think about the first time, and you might remember this, Tom, I read the work of the profoundly homophobic but very powerful legal philosopher John Finnis. So Finnis made some very significant and deleterious, or attemptedly deleterious, interventions into debates about gay rights, in which he argued in one piece in 1997 that all three of the greatest Greek philosophers, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, you know, regarded homosexual conduct as shameful, etc., etc. And I remember thinking to myself at that point, look, John, you can have Plato's Socrates if you want, but I'm not sure you can have both Plato and Socrates as sort of robustly distinct figures with easily distinguishable views, given that the evidence that we have for what Socrates thought about anything was at best speech reported by Plato, quite possibly speech made up by Plato. Right, there is no Socrates unmediated by Plato. And I think this is just sort of one interesting example of the way of what certain people are kind of willing to say about Plato's texts. To make those sources do work for a contemporary ideological agenda. I mean, this, by the way, is just why it's so important that we continue to encourage students to read these texts, right? Because we want them to see when they're being co-opted in the present. But to the specific point about Diotima, look, it's absolutely no surprise to me that the same male readers who had such trouble seeing the women around them as intellectual equals, right, even when those women are typing and editing and discussing their manuscripts, were resistant to the idea that a woman might have been, you know, at least somewhere behind the so-called founder of the Western philosophical tradition.
And of course, I mean, one of the reasons that Diotima can't speak for herself, but is ventriloquized by Socrates, is because women were not invited to symposiums in classical Athens as guests. I mean, there were women present at them, unless they're sent away. I mean, there are enslaved musicians and sex workers who are sent away at the beginning of the symposium so that the, you know, elite men can have their dialogue. So, and as you make clear in the piece, I mean, there have always been these barriers of class and race as well as sex and gender. But women in philosophy, as you put it, have always needed a special stroke of luck, as well as all the kinds of luck that men have needed. What is that extra luck that women have needed?
Well, you know, as I discuss in the piece, for a very long time, and I'm sort of sad to say it, but it's true, the extra stroke of luck that most women needed was access to a man who would give them an education that they were, you know, otherwise denied. I think that it is probably, if you look at the stories of many prominent contemporary women philosophers, also true that a number of them might suggest that they had a kind of lucky break with a teacher who, because of the kind of demographics of philosophy, would very often have been a man who was sort of willing to buck the trend. But I think that, you know, part of what your question also gets at is the way in which, you know, the barriers are not just barriers of gender, but barriers of class and race.
On a slightly different point, I mean, that idea of Finnis, that you can read the symposium and think that Socrates and Plato disapproved of homosexual love,
right,
is pretty bizarre anyway, apart from anything else. But the
yes, yeah. Right. That's the real objection.
I mean, it's a very contrary reading, but anyway, that. But I mean, the question of these barriers in philosophy, I mean, in other disciplines as well, that, I mean, it's just anecdotal evidence. So when my sister was studying natural sciences at Cambridge in the 1990s, there were not that many women in her class. And one of her teachers, so there were three women, a lot of men, and one of her teachers would refer to the three women as the bimbos. Well, I suppose it is quite a long time ago now, but even if you'd have thought, surely in the 1990s, no one would do that, but they did. And, you know, and you might think that STEM subjects are particularly more sexist, more male-dominated, but philosophy suffers from similar problems, right?
No, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I was really struck by while I was researching this piece was the evidence that suggests that philosophy has a worse gender balance among, or a gender ratio among PhD recipients than certain STEM subjects. But I think you're quite right not to allow the focus on philosophy to distract from, you know, the rampant prejudice faced by women in those disciplines. I mean, you know, my best friend, when we were undergrads, so this is the kind of mid-2000s, was a chemical engineer. And in order to get access to her problem sheets every week, she had to go through her supervisor's website. And on the front page, there are a list of what he, I guess, thought were his most notable quotations, one of which was, "I'll never have a woman in my group." And so she sort of had to click through this to get, in order to do the work that he was then going to mark. It won't surprise you to learn that even though she came top of her year, she didn't become a chemical engineer.
It was a great loss to chemical engineering, apart from anything else.
Yes, seriously.
So this question of the luck that women in philosophy and other disciplines needed, which is to have men, well, a teacher who would help them or give them access, and because of already existing demographics, that was often a man, so that women needed men to allow them access. And once they did have, I mean, there was this assumption that you say quite a lot to the piece, that somehow these women who, oh, okay, so these women are okay, they're philosophers, they're really clever, but they're not normal women. They're somehow exceptional in this way. They're not really womanly, so they don't count, which seems as such a catch-22.
No, absolutely. Monsters or miracles of nature, as someone writing about Anna Maria van Sherman, a man writing about Anna Maria van Sherman once put it. And it's important to note that often these women themselves participated in that rhetoric. So Elizabeth of Bohemia is a great example, you know, Descartes' great interlocutor, philosophically brilliant in her own right, but repeated and endorsed the idea that the female sex was the weaker sex, and that in a way she was in some sense exceptional. So it wasn't just the men who were, you know, perpetuating this exceptionalism. And of course, what you see increasingly happen in the 17th century is a resistance on the part of women writers to these discourses of exceptionalism, right? They want to say, like, hang on a second, the history of women's thinking is sufficient to suggest that all sorts of women could do this, could do philosophy. Now, again, you know, there are constraints there, certainly around race and around class. This wasn't a case for all women's minds, but it was a pushback at the very least against kind of hyperbolic exceptionalism.
And I mean, of course, it wasn't for all men either. The idea that men philosophers are a minority among men, but no one, well, maybe they did, I don't know, but no one went around suggesting that Descartes was somehow unmanly for doing philosophy. I mean, I suppose some people might say that it is unmanly and that he should have been out on the rugby pitch, as it were, but it's not the same. It's a different kind of exceptionalism. You can say these male geniuses are exceptional for being geniuses or the rest of it, but they're not unmanned by it in the way that women philosophers were described as being.
Yeah. I mean, I think you do raise an important point, and I imagine that, you know, there will be plenty of men in philosophy who will want to say, hey, hang on a second, I absolutely had the experience of being bullied and excluded for being an intellectual, and that this often was done in gendered terms. I think what's interesting about this case, particularly in early modernity, is when you look at the sort of history of, let's call it canonical philosophy, you know, particularly someone like Aristotle, who for so many centuries was the reigning authority in European universities, the conception of the human being that Aristotle uses is the sort of hyper-rational man. It's the man of reason who is great-souled, who, you know, might not be strong of body, but is great of mind. And I think that figures like Descartes, philosophical men, were in a way a relief to other men, because for once we have someone who can fulfill this extraordinary and idealized notion of the human. Now, of course, the truth is no one fulfills these extraordinary and idealized notions of the human. And that's one thing that's, I mean, quite interesting about these philosophical accounts of human nature is quite how removed they are from the realities of, you know, human life and what it is to interact with each other and what we're all really like.
So women philosophers, you say in the piece, regularly charged men with the fallacy of confusing custom for nature, including Christine de Pizan in the early 15th century. So this isn't a new idea. This challenge to this idea of the way things are and the way they ought to be get muddled up.
Right, absolutely. We might sort of want to hold apart here what's going on with the fallacy of confusing custom for nature from the kind of question of how we can derive, and if indeed we can derive, normativity from descriptivity, right? So when these women philosophers are objecting as early as the 15th century to these men who are, as they say, confusing custom for nature, what they're trying to get at is the fact that, you know, men are describing certain traits and characteristics and practices as natural or necessary, which should in fact be seen as the products of socialization, right, of custom, of culture. And as you say, I mean, it sort of blew my mind the first time I read de Pizan on this, because I had been brought up to think that this was a quote-unquote relatively new insight. So I think I thought that this was something that, you know, because it was such a central cry of women's liberationists in the 1970s, I hadn't realised quite how old a claim this was and old an insight this was. I think it's interesting that this isn't regularly taught, you know, to everybody in courses, you know, in great books courses or, you know, whatever, core curriculum courses or history of political thought courses. And these aren't, you know, these are often quite nuanced insights into how, you know, ideology works. So in the piece I discuss what is basically my favorite example of this kind of insight by an Italian writer, Moderata Fonte, in a work of hers that was published posthumously in 1600. So she describes the whole notion of women's inferiority as an abuse that has been introduced into the world and that men have gradually translated into law and custom, so entrenched that they claim and actually believe that the status they've gained by bullying is theirs by right. Now, I think that, in a sentence, is just an extraordinary analysis of how ideology works and how it's perpetuated. And indeed, by the way, it might be something of an answer to your initial question about, you know, why women are continually left out of histories of philosophy. Because what starts as an act of bullying by some men in the mid-19th century becomes just a matter of kind of common and unquestioned belief, even by people who are, as I say, are professionally tasked to question our received beliefs. You know, there are many other examples of this from the piece that I didn't have room to include. And I think that fact is also interesting, Tom, the fact that this isn't an insight that is limited to a kind of, you know, a couple of, however, you know, a dismissive interlocutor might want to put it, you know, random women who are easily sidelined. I think, you know, one of the most famous examples of this insight, or it should be famous, comes in Thomas Hobbes's Leviathan, right? So here's a text that, you know, any undergraduate who studies the history of political philosophy, any undergraduate who's made to do some kind of core course in Western Phil or Western Civ probably comes across. How many of them are taught and asked to discuss the bit in that text when Hobbes ridicules his male contemporaries for assuming that the reason they enjoy exclusive rights to their children is because, as Hobbes puts it, they think they're of the more excellent sex? Hobbes has a riposte to that. He says, commonwealths tend to be founded by men. And this, not any natural superiority, explains why things so often go their way. So even someone like Hobbes, he's onto this old de Pisan argument, right? And yet, I was taught Hobbes. I've spent much of my life thinking about Hobbes. This was something I sort of, you know, had to read things that weren't mainstream on the syllabus to come to see and understand the place of this insight in the history of philosophy. Now, this thought that men confuse custom for nature is distinct from the point that that it is a bad inference to go from a descriptive claim to a normative claim, or to kind of infer a normative claim from a descriptive claim. So this is what we're talking about when we talk about the is-ought problem, right? It's a kind of... the is-ought problem is refers to a question of kind of how you can get a normative claim, a claim about how things ought to be or should be, from a claim about how things are. And many contemporary philosophers will tell you that you simply cannot derive a normative conclusion from a purely descriptive, premises, right? And when philosophers teach this problem, they often suggest that Hume was the first to see it. But if you actually look at the pseudonymous text written by someone who went under the name of Sophia, it's published in 1739, Woman Not Inferior to Man. So this is published in 1739. It's a year before Hume's Treatise of Human Nature. You find the author raise exactly this issue under a discussion of whether women are fit for public office, right? And it's a kind of scathing discussion of the intellectual errors male thinkers make when they try and do this thing of deriving a normative conclusion from descriptive premises, right? That just is the is-ought problem. And she even, well, I'm going to use the pronoun she, but this author even uses this language of, you know, ought in describing it. So to me, this is just a clear statement of the is-ought problem. And its real interest is not actually whether or not this text was really written by a woman, right? There have been speculations about which 18th century women it might be written by. I don't actually think that's the real point here, right? I actually think the real point is, regardless of whether it's a man or a woman, this is a text written by someone complaining not only about sexism, but about the sexism of philosophers in particular. And yet, nonetheless, they have all been so very keen to attribute this insight to a male thinker who was not particularly enlightened in his views on all sorts of things, including race and gender, who wrote it a year later. Now, could Hume have known this text? I mean, look, I'm not a Hume scholar, but I am reliably informed that, you know, after several years of living in France, by 1739, Hume was back living just outside Edinburgh, so he had access to its booksellers. It's not impossible that he knew it.
And in any case, even if he reached those ideas independently, he's credited as being the first, even though he's not, because this book was published earlier and it makes the argument. So whether or not he was influenced by it or not, he's still... I mean, whether or not it matters who's the first. I mean, people who think it matters would rather it was the big man than the anonymous.
Right, precisely. I mean, it's just, yeah, a key distinction here between precedent and plagiarism. We don't need Hume to be a plagiarist in order to think that it's worthwhile to point out that there are precedents.
Yeah. you know, as you say in the piece, I mean, so there was this move in the 19th century by the men to keep women out of philosophy, out of educational establishments, out of universities. That eventually failed, thankfully. And I mean, there was a hope that the sexism would go away if women were given equal access to education, or that at least things would change. But that isn't exactly how it turned out, is it? I mean, obviously things are better now than they were 150 years ago.
Yeah. Yes. I don't think it's in anyone's interest to suggest that there have been no relevant changes. I mean, I think it's important when we have these conversations to point out that there just still isn't equal access to education of anything like the kind, you know, to which we all might aspire. It's, and I sort of feel I have to say this, teaching in the kind of university that I teach in, right? It's access to which is eased considerably by having parents who are able and willing to pay for certain educational advantages, private tutoring, private education, a house in a postcode with, you know, high-performing state schools. I think considerations like these matter for thinking about women in philosophy because they do go some way to explaining which women have been able to succeed in the discipline. I mean, again, this is purely anecdotal, but when I look at a lot of prominent women philosophers, whatever distinguishes them kind of intellectually or sociologically, they often have kind of class advantage in common. But we might still want to say that the story here is kind of broadly positive, right? Because after all, in the UK, if you look at the numbers of students electing to study undergraduate philosophy, you see about a 50-50 split when it comes to gender. I think the last count it had is 52% men undergraduates and 48% women. So that means philosophy is looking kind of equally attractive as a degree coming out of school to men and women students. But then when you look at PhD degrees, right, you see in the same data collection, about a third are going to women. So the question is, what's happening in the meantime, right? And one way of putting that question is, you know, what's putting women off philosophy?
I mean, what is the answer to that? I mean, you mentioned in your piece there's a blog, or there was, I don't know, is it still exists? What is it like to be a woman in philosophy, where people get to say, not great?
Yeah. I think what I took from that blog and from the conversations I had with various friends was that there is just still quite a shocking degree of overt contempt for women sort of shown to them by men. And we're not just talking about teachers here, we're also talking about peers in the discipline. I think it can just still feel like a boys' club, and women who want to be in that club have to sort of work out their way of breaking in.
I mean, do you have any examples of things from that blog, stories from that blog, or of your own that illustrate what it's the difficulties?
Yeah, I actually think that one of the things, you know, you learn from that blog is that a lot still depends on how lucky you are, right? And I actually see this all the time with my own students. I have a really brilliant graduate student at the moment. She was a philosophy major at Columbia. She was mentored there by the philosopher Christian Mercer, who's also an editor of the series Oxford New Books in the Histories of Philosophy. So this is one of the figures who's been trying for some time now to kind of change how philosophy conceives of itself and its history. And I think about how lucky my student was, and so how in turn how lucky I am, that there was someone in that philosophy department who sort of saw her talent and decided to nurture it, right? In the same way, I mean, there's just a very basic connection between, you know, this case and someone like Mary Astell, right? Who had an uncle, Ralph, to whom she's sent for lessons, and he delights in her brilliance, right? He decides to nurture it. He leaves her his library. In a period of kind of widespread prejudice, that's a stroke of luck. But I think one thing you see in this blog that relates to this is that many other women are just not so lucky, right? They're taught by men, and let's be honest, very often women, because there is a long history of women succeeding, not just in philosophy, but across the academy, and then kicking down on the next generation, right? But these are men who kind of allow sexist dynamics into their classrooms, who say things that embolden young men to dismiss women or treat them as intellectually inferior. And I think what's really interesting, and you get this from the blog, from talking to women in philosophy, is that these professors are not always outwardly sexist or predatory men, right? It sounds like philosophy has its fair share of those, and it might be interesting as to why that is. But often it's actually men who, on the face of things, are perfectly supportive of women, right? Men who might call themselves feminists and who don't actually see the ways that they create a culture that makes it harder for women to succeed in the discipline or feel they have a place in it. So in the piece, I talk a bit with my own experiences of this kind of thing. And the example, one of the examples I give, and it's the example I sort of feel most ambivalent about, is the philosopher Raymond Geuss, because Geuss was a hero to loads of us, right? Like, when the student occupations happened around tuition fees in 2010, he was one of a small number of faculty who went to huge lengths to support us, right? Geuss supervised one of my favorite feminist philosophers, Lorna Finlayson. He was a mesmerizing lecturer, right? Lectures he gave on Nietzsche, Hegel, Foucault. They're hugely popular, but they're hugely popular also among a certain kind of young, lefty, theory-oriented man, right? So here you have to imagine Geuss in his lecture hall, these boys sitting at his feet, right? Boys who, when they took at that time a course in political philosophy, could study one woman as a standalone topic, and that was Rosa Luxemburg. And he launches into this poem he'd written about Hannah Arendt, which I cite in the piece. It's very short. She lived as a Hausfrau, thought as a Hausfrau, and died as a Hausfrau doing the shopping. Now look, do I think this poem is the worst thing in the world or that Raymond Geuss is the worst sexist I've ever come across? Absolutely not. But in a way, something like this was worse coming from Geuss, right? One of the few people who would teach you Marx, who would teach you Foucault with care and diligence, than it would have been coming from some kind of self-aggrandizing bigot who's performative about saying sexist things and wanting to get away with it. Like, I mean, from Geuss, it felt like some kind of betrayal, in part because his own, you know, lefty credentials meant that it was so easy, and in fact, I did feel this way, sort of feel so small and bourgeois for objecting, right? Like, it felt as if, you know, as long as you've got the right class analysis, then all sexism can be excused. But the point here is, like, is this really how those of us who dislike Arendt should be engaging with her or taught to engage with her? Like, we don't engage with her arguments, we just make these, frankly, ad hominem complaints, which reduce to dismissing her because she's a certain kind of woman.
Also, what does it say about, you know, women's unpaid labour, of, you know, the work of the Hausfrau? I mean, maybe let's not be so dismissive of that.
Right, right. I mean, no, quite. And one thing I was going to say is, look, well, what does that mean for how we should treat theorists of wages for housework, right? Many of whom were, you know, self-identifying and proud Hausfraus, and some of the most kind of insightful and scintillating theorists of the 20th century. Now, look, like, does Geuss think we should dismiss them on the same grounds too? And even if Geuss has the self-discipline to limit his sexism to Arendt, like, right? Like, were the boys he was lecturing to, like, able to kind of have the same nuance? Were they hearing that nuance? Or were they just hearing that it's fine to use gender as grounds for philosophical dismissal? And I don't know, what I felt in that moment was that Geuss went from being kind of one of the most exciting contrarian philosophers that I'd heard to just another male philosopher doing what they've done for generations. And, you know, Tom, we've talked a lot about gender, but we haven't talked as much about race, right? But there was this 2018 study, and the numbers are not precise, but of something like 10,000 PhD trained philosophers in the US, they estimated that 38 were black women. So I think, you know, the question of what is it like to be a woman in philosophy is going to be answered very differently if you're a woman of color in philosophy, subject to very particular forms and modes of prejudice. and different kinds of historic barriers to entry, because we've talked a lot about, you know, this late 19th century moment when women are allowed into universities. But of course, which women? Well, if we're looking at the US case, the barriers to entry for Black women were much higher and much more robustly policed and kept in place for much longer than they were for, say, middle-class white women. And in a way, this is why in my work and in the piece, I wanted to draw attention to the fact that, you know, it's not just white women who've been writing kind of histories of philosophy that say things about Mary Astell and Mary Wollstonecraft. The very first in-print use of the phrase intellectual history that I can find published in the US was by a Black woman intellectual. It was by a woman called Gertrude Bustill Mossel. It's published in 1894, the work of the Afro-American woman. And in it, she makes the case for why intellectual history, any intellectual history written in the future, doesn't just have to include the work of African-American men, it has to include the work of African-American women. And she draws attention to all of these authors who in some contexts today are experienced a much welcome renaissance, Anna Julia Cooper, Ida B. Wells. But Mossel was there at the end of the 19th century, the very moment when intellectual history is emerging as a kind of professional discipline in the historical, in the kind of mainstream American academy, right? This is a kind of process that is developing through until the 1930s. There she is, right at the beginning, saying, look, if you're going to do this thing, you have to include the works of Black women. Now, the fact that this is not, this, I've never been taught this book. There are mentions of this book, of course, in histories of Black women's intellectualism. But in histories of intellectual history, the practice of writing the history of philosophy, say, she's not there. Even in histories that look to kind of chart the rise of something like African-American intellectual history, Mossel's not mentioned. Now, do I think this is, you know, one of the... Even one of the main impediments to Black women entering the academy and entering philosophy? Of course I don't. Do I think it's a contributory factor, the fact that these attempts to get Black women's minds on the record are repeatedly effaced? Yeah, I think it has to be a factor.
And is it a problem as well that they tend to be siloed, that somehow you... I mean, it's just called Black women's thought, but white men's thought is not, you know, listed under white men's thought. And it probably should be.
No, absolutely. I mean, I'm the editor of a journal, and the title of our journal is The Journal of the History of Ideas. And it's the longest running intellectual history journal. It was founded in 1940. And I recently did a review of every article we published. So the phrase Black women has appeared 4 times in the journal's history, and in only one occasion in an article that had anything to say about the actual ideas of Black women. But just more generally, there are, I think, 2 articles in the journal's lifetime have focused on the thought of a woman of colour. So, you know, when we talk about the Journal of the History of Ideas, to your point, one wants to say, well, whose ideas, right? And this is something that I and a great many other number of other people in the discipline are kind of concerned to address. But yes, sometimes I feel like maybe it should be renamed, you know, the Journal of Early Modern White European Male Ideas. I'll probably get into trouble for saying that. You should probably cut that.
But I mean, it's important to say, I mean, as you do make clear in the piece, that the books you're reviewing, I mean, certainly the Routledge Handbook of Women in Early Modern European Philosophy, you know, is continuing the work that has been going on for decades of not forgetting.
Right, absolutely. And look, I think one thing to point out about the Routledge volume is that many of the contributors to that volume are the same people who have worked for the last several decades to really put women in the history of philosophy on the academic map. So to be very clear, I'm not saying, oh, women have always been in the mainstream. It's always been possible to teach women to the same level of sophistication as it has been the male philosophers. Of course not. I'm just concerned that the way that we talk about the history of ideas doesn't collude with the men who want to kind of self-exculpate by saying, how could we possibly have known about these women? No, there were texts. But it's absolutely right to say that in the last 40 years, women in the academy and several men have put an awful lot of graft into making it possible to teach women to think about women in philosophy with the same level of sophistication as it is possible to kind of teach and think about the men. When in the piece I kind of called the Routledge volume a monument to a scholarly sea change, I really meant that. You know, these, it is written by the people who have, through determination, being repeatedly rebuffed, no doubt facing all kinds of prejudice, have insisted that they are going to remake the philosophical world. And they have done. But I think we still need to be alert to the thought that the fact that it exists now and that they've provided us with the resources to change how we teach philosophy doesn't mean that those changes are going to happen, right? And it doesn't mean that those changes are going to be robust into the future.
Because as you've seen repeatedly, the forgetting happens over and over again, mysteriously, or not so mysteriously. But is there, I mean, not that Routledge volume, but is there, are there, if we continue to talk about certain philosophers as having been forgotten and having been lost, and is there a danger that you're somehow insisting on them still having that status in some sense? Because I mean, there's a contradiction in terms almost in having, here is a, if you've written a biography of a forgotten person, well, they haven't been forgotten because here you are remembering them, but somehow insisting on their status as still being forgotten, even though they've been recovered. Does that inhibit the recovery somehow?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there are sort of often in different contexts, two different things going on here. So I think the market likes something that's been forgotten or lost, right? It likes innovation, it likes novelty. I think it's much easier to sell lost women than it is women whose, you know, inheritance is complicated, or yeah, some people have known about them, some people haven't, you know, it's thickety. I can see how that doesn't sell books, but you know, and I'm absolutely not talking about the Routledge volume here. I want to make that very clear. But I have seen and read examples of this kind of recovery work in academic publications, which have nothing to say about, which basically are sort of parasitical on a general sense that we, quote unquote, don't know anything about these women. And they end up repeating things that have actually been published about these women as novel arguments.
Is there a way to make sure that this kind of cycle of, this convenient cycle of forgetting can be avoided? That somehow say, here are all these thinkers who have been overlooked in the past, but here they are, they have been recovered to the extent they need to be recovered, and let's keep them in sight and not forget them again, so they don't have to be recovered again in another generation, and this sort of same work being done over and over again. How do we keep these thinkers in view?
Yeah. The feminist theorist Barbara Smith has a wonderful quotation which I love. She says, for books to be real and remembered, they have to be talked about. And I think the onus is on us to make sure not just that, you know, these historical women are talked about, by which I mean, you know, taught in our syllabuses, seen as legitimate objects of academic research, and not simply kind of, you know, ghettoized and, as you previously put it so nicely, siloed, but included within our kind of the texture of the history of philosophy, right? So you don't just teach Elizabeth of Bohemia as a woman philosopher, you teach her on alongside Descartes as a crucial interlocutor, which she was, right? You work out ways to integrate women into the history of ideas that is true to the actual history of ideas, right? Where they were working alongside, thinking alongside the men on whom men so like to focus. I mean, you know, Tom, it's really difficult right now. I anticipated that you were going to ask me about cycles of forgetting. And the thing I kept thinking about was, you know, the thing that's kind of keeping us all up at night at the moment, right? Which is that we're having this conversation at a moment when every single university in Gaza has been destroyed, right? And the students in other universities who are protesting this brutality are themselves being brutalized by the same people whose job it is to protect them and to protect their academic freedom. Now, what we're witnessing here is one way that the powerful have kind of always tried to erase what they want the future to forget through physical aggression and ideological suppression. So, you know, I don't want to perform any kind of arrogance of the present here by saying, you know, that I have views about what the future will be allowed to read or what mainstream sources are going to say is the truth of the past. Because as a historian, I'm pretty pessimistic at the moment about what that will be. And, you know, when you add to that the fact that this is also a moment when I have colleagues in the US who are unable to teach certain books or scared to teach certain books about race or sexuality or gender, right? Because they're banned or because there are going to be professional consequences for doing so. Black women colleagues of mine in the US are being targeted by scam plagiarism charges by conservative activists who are being sort of fueled online by Elon Musk. This is all about undermining and unseating them, right? These are the contexts in which our own cycles of forgetting and remembering are going to play out. And asking about how we avoid that is a difficult question. Because it sometimes feels like you're up against forces that are a lot more powerful and much better organized. So I think, you know, one thing as a historian I can say is that we just always have to kind of avoid giving in to the kind of hubris of the present, right? Not thinking we're the first to battle injustice, not thinking we're the first to discover the past, the first to challenge the status quo. And always being alert to the fact that there are going to be texts and sources out there that for various reasons people have wanted to marginalize, and it's our job to go looking for them. And I think that's a kind of good principle to operate with in the face of these repeated cycles of forgetting.
Sophie Smith, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can read Sophie Smith's piece in the 25th of April issue of the LRV. And there's a new issue out now with pieces by Julian Barnes, Malcolm Gaskell, Sheila Fitzpatrick, Rosemary Hill, and many others. The LRB podcast is produced by Anthony Wilkes and Zoe Kilbourne. The music is by Kieran Brunt. I'm Thomas Jones. Thank you for listening.